The Appropriations Committee will come to order. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Leak?
Here.
Vice Chair McClure?
I'm here.
Committee Whip Mooney?
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll?
Here.
Representatives Altman? Andrade?
Here.
Bell?
Here.
Benjamin?
Present.
Brannon?
Here.
Posada Cabrera?
Here.
Cheney?
Here.
Fine?
Here.
Garrison?
Here.
Gottlieb? Grant?
Here.
Gregory?
Here.
Hawkins?
Here.
Hunchowski?
Here.
Joseph, excused. Masullo?
Here.
Payne?
Here.
Perez?
Here.
Rommel?
Here.
Sosman?
Here.
Schoaf? Silvers? Skidmore?
Here.
Stevenson? Tomko?
Here.
Williams?
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Appropriations Committee. Please make sure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today we will hear a presentation on the Governor's recommended budget for fiscal year 2023 to 2024 by Chris Spencer, the Director of the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget. Mr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Leak and members of the committee. It is my privilege to present the Framework for Freedom budget for Governor Ron DeSantis for fiscal year 2023-2024. The Framework for Freedom budget sets a bold vision for Florida and prioritizes taxpayer resources in strategic priorities that I will outline in this presentation. Joining me today are the professional experts of the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget, as well as the heads of our executive agencies. The Framework for Freedom budget totals $114.8 billion, which is $3.8 billion or 3.4% above the current year budget. General revenue appropriations of the Framework for Freedom budget total $42.4 billion, which is $304 million below the total current year general revenue appropriations, reflecting a 0.7% decrease. This chart presents an overall picture of the Framework for Freedom budget by policy area. The chart on the left represents all funds, including trust funds, and the chart on the right represents general revenue specifically. Health and Human Services continues to be the largest portion of the overall budget, with $47.6 billion, or 41.4% of the total budget, and $14.9 billion of this is general revenue. Education spending is the second largest funded area in the budget, making up $30.4 billion, or 26.5% of the total state budget. The general revenue portion of education totals $19.4 billion, providing the education system with the largest portion of general revenue funds available at 45.6%. Transportation and economic development is the third largest portion of the budget, with $19.9 billion, or 17.3% of the total budget. In the development of the Framework for Freedom budget, the governor set out to prioritize recruitment and retention issues across our state agencies. Later in this presentation, I will explain the governor's comprehensive pay package to address these challenges. The Framework for Freedom budget establishes over 600 new positions in strategically important programs across agencies, but offsets that with the elimination of chronically vacant positions across the enterprise. This strategy resulted in a total of 112,307 positions, which is a net decrease of 46 positions over the current year. No positions eliminated in the Framework for Freedom budget are currently filled, and the elimination of these vacant positions will not have detrimental impact on agency operations or services. The Governor's Framework for Freedom budget again recommends historic reserves, as well as the creation of a new reserve fund for the state. Governor DeSantis leaves $15.7 billion in total reserves in the Framework for Freedom budget, which is 13.7% of the total budget. This includes $6.9 billion in unallocated general revenue, of which $1 billion is recurring. The governor recommends an additional $300 million transfer into the Budget Stabilization Fund, bringing the total balance to more than $3.4 billion, up from $1.4 billion just 5 years ago. Additionally, the governor recommends a transfer of $1 billion into the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund to accommodate any emergency needs of the state. The Florida Optional Reinsurance Assistance Reserve of $1 billion remains in general revenue reserves in anticipation of future needs in the 2023 hurricane season. Lastly, Governor DeSantis recommends establishing the State Investment Fund as a reserve of the state and proposes a transfer of $1 billion into this new reserve fund. The State Investment Fund is proposed to be established at the State Board of Administration. In addition to the $1 billion initial transfer, beginning in fiscal year 24-25, $100 million of general revenue generated from the normal investment earnings on the state treasury balance will be annually transferred into the fund. The fund will be a reserve of last resort below the budget stabilization fund. The fund will be structured so that the first 3% of investment earnings will be retained in the fund. Earnings in excess of 3% annually and up to 5.5% will be available to the Division of Bond Finance for a newly proposed debt reduction program, and any earnings above 5.5% will be returned to the General Revenue Fund. The newly proposed debt reduction program will allow the state to retire outstanding debt prior to maturity, generating savings by avoiding interest costs. The governor recommends an initial $400 million transfer to the debt reduction program for the defeasance of two sets of currently outstanding bonds. The first set are PICO taxable bonds maturing in 2024 and 2025, and this will save the state approximately $15 million in avoided interest costs. And the second set of bonds are state revolving loan fund taxable bonds maturing beginning in 2024, and this will save the state over $16 million in avoided interest costs. The $400 million initial transfer, coupled with a recurring annual transfer from the State Investment Fund, will establish an evergreen fund for the accelerated reduction of state debt, as much as $1.3 billion of accelerated reduction of state debt over 20 years, actually paying down debt faster while Washington hopelessly accumulates more. Using the current FRS return assumption, the ending balance of the State Investment Fund may reach as high as $4.3 billion over 20 years, providing a robust, permanent layer of reserves for the state. This slide reflects the general revenue outlook for the Framework for Freedom budget. After adjusting the beginning cash balance of $12.1 billion for over $2.3 billion in revenues Florida has received in excess of the August estimates and $1.7 billion in Medicaid and KidCare reversions and more than $5.2 billion in current year expenditure adjustments, the largest portion being $4 billion in the Moving Florida Forward initiative, available general revenue totals $53.4 billion for fiscal year 23-24. Measures affecting revenue, including the governor's proposed tax package, total $1.3 billion, and another $569 million is deducted for transfers to the debt reduction program and state employee health insurance, and transfers to state reserves total $2.3 billion. The proposed general revenue expenditures of the Framework for Freedom budget totals $42.4 billion, leaving the ending general revenue balance on June 30, 2024 at $6.9 billion. There are no anticipated FEMA reimbursements factored into the Framework for Freedom budget revenue outlook this year. However, a conservative estimate of the amount owed to the state from prior storms, pandemic expenditures, and the 2022 hurricane is over $2.4 billion. The governor's budget includes recommended changes to the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund established last year, which include an annual transfer of up to $1 billion to ensure the fund is adequately prepared for any declared emergencies. The governor's recommended changes also include authorizing all FEMA reimbursements to be deposited directly into the fund for declared emergencies occurring on or after July 1, 2022, and authorizing up to $500 million of FEMA reimbursements to be deposited directly into the fund for declared emergencies, declared emergencies occurring prior to July 1, 2022. Anything above this $500 million aggregate amount will be deposited into the General Revenue Fund. The Framework for Freedom budget proposes to cut taxes by an unprecedented $2 billion. With the historic reserves Florida has maintained, Governor DeSantis believes that we should put money back in the pockets of Florida families. Together with the $500 million of toll relief program that began on January 1 of this year, the governor's $2 billion tax package includes $324.5 million in permanent tax cuts, which include a permanent tax cut on baby and toddler necessities to save Florida families $138.7 million, a permanent tax cut on cribs and strollers for $3.9 million, a permanent tax cut on gas stoves for $6.9 million, and to make clear to overreaching federal bureaucrats that in Florida, gas stoves aren't going anywhere. A permanent tax cut on over-the-counter pet medications for $33.6 million. An increase in the amount of savings to businesses that e-file their sales taxes online to save Florida businesses $141.4 million. The Framework for Freedom budget's historic tax package also includes sales tax savings to Florida families of over $1.2 billion, including a one-year sales tax holiday on cosmetic products and toiletries. That total is $72 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on dental and oral hygiene products for $45.3 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on children's books for $17.3 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on children's toys for $132.7 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on children's athletic equipment for $42.5 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on household items under $25 in value for $138 million. The governor's tax proposal also continues the sales tax holidays that have been in the budget over the last several years. Two 14-day back-to-school sales tax holidays to save Florida families a total of $210 million. The additional back-to-school sales tax holiday this year in this proposal will start before the spring semester as kids are returning from winter break. A 15-year summer freedom sales tax holiday for $224 million. A one-year sales tax holiday on pet food for $170.2 million. A 7-day skilled worker tool sales tax holiday for $13 million. A 14-day disaster preparedness sales tax holiday for $27.1 million. A one-year tax holiday on Energy Star appliances for $82.4 million, and a two-year extension on the natural gas fuel tax exemption for $1.2 million. These tax cuts are meant to deliver relief to common products purchased by Florida families as we continue to suffer the inflationary effects of the fiscal mismanagement from Washington, D.C. The Framework for Freedom budget recommends $694.5 million in pay increases for state employees. The bulk of the pay package is for an across-the-board 5% increase to address the pinch that our employees are feeling in their wallets thanks to historic inflation. $91.6 million is provided for an average 10% increase for the recruitment and retention of specific positions in state government that have proven hard to fill. I'll explain that in a later slide. Over $116 million is provided to the Department of Corrections to increase the base rate of pay to $23 per hour for correctional officers and to address compression and implementation of a retention plan at the Department of Corrections. $76.5 million is provided to increase the minimum pay for state law enforcement officers to $55,000, provide an additional 4% to FDLE sworn law enforcement personnel, and provide additional increases to all state law enforcement officers, which I'll explain also at a later slide. $42.5 million is recommended for other state agency-specific pay adjustments, including $21.7 million to provide an increase to Department of Children and Families, Child Protective Investigators, and Economic Self-Sufficiency positions, and $1.4 million for pay increases for the recruitment and retention of Department of Business and Professional Regulation licensing specialists. The governor's Framework for Freedom pay package methodology first starts with a statewide 5% increase to filled and vacant positions, effective July 1, 2023. All other pay increases are then applied on top of this statewide 5% increase. For the hard-to-hire positions or hard-to-fill positions, we averaged the current pay range of all of those position classes across the enterprise after factoring in the 5% across-the-board pay increase, and then provided a subsequent 10% increase above that statewide average by class, and that is effective October 1st of 2023. Those positions that are considered hard to fill are in accounting, budgeting, finance, auditing, attorneys and paralegals, information technology, laboratory technicians, and in nursing field. The October 1 effective date provides for agencies to develop their implementation plan for the distribution of these funds within their agency. The average across agencies by class code will allow for more resources to be provided to agencies that are currently paying lower salaries for those hard-to-fill positions. Then, the Department of Corrections pay package is specifically provided to bring the correctional officers to $23 per hour and provide for compression, retention, and pay parity of other departmental staff. The fourth step focused on state law enforcement personnel. The law enforcement minimum is raised to $55,000, and a two-pronged pay adjustment is then made based on current pay brackets and then also years of service, which I'll explain at the law enforcement slide later. The additional 4% increase for FDLE specifically is then applied after all other law enforcement increases are factored in. Lastly, the state agency pay increase were applied to the adjusted base established after the statewide 5% increase, and that would be effective also on July 1st, 2023. These include a 3% pay increase for state attorneys and a pay step plan increase for assistant state attorneys, the increase for DCF and for DBPR that I've already mentioned, and an increase in the minimum pay for administrative law judges, judges of compensation claims, and DOA. Governor DeSantis maintains his commitment to our state law enforcement personnel by recommending $271 million of the total $694.5 million Framework for Freedom pay package as pay increases for state sworn law enforcement officers. And this is the largest state law enforcement officer pay increase in Florida history. I already highlighted the pay increase for correctional officers, and the remaining $155.4 million pay increase includes $32.3 million provided to increase the minimum pay to $55,000 and provide additional percentage increases based on the ranges of the current officer pay. $42.3 million is provided to increase existing officer pay based on years of service, and $1.9 million is provided for the additional 4% at FDLE. Under the governor's leadership, Florida continues to be the education state. Florida's education system is ranked number one in education freedom and continues to be the number one ranked higher education system in the nation. The Framework for Freedom budget provides an historic $26 billion investment in our K-12 education system with a continued rise year over year in per pupil level of funding. $14.1 billion of this is provided in state funds and $11.8 billion is provided in required local funding. The Florida Education Finance Program, or FEFP, includes an increase of $575.9 million in state funding and $865.8 million in local funding. This includes the highest per student funding of $8,453, which is an increase of $205 over the current fiscal year. Governor DeSantis is once again recommending to increase teacher pay this year by an additional $200 million for a total of $1 billion. Under the governor's proposal, school districts will have the flexibility to use this increase in their teacher pay funding to provide salary increases to eligible teachers and other instructional personnel in the manner that best fits their district's needs. The Framework for Freedom budget also includes increases in key areas of our education budget, including an increase of $121 in the base student allocation, which provides districts with flexible funding of $409.6 million. An increase of $20 million for a total of $160 million to ensure that our students' mental health needs are being met, and an increase of $40 million for a total of $250 million for safe school initiatives. To continue our priority of ensuring that Florida's students and teachers can learn in a safe environment, the Framework for Freedom budget includes $487.3 million in the following school safety initiatives, which includes the Safe Schools initiatives I've mentioned, as well as $6.5 million for the Coach Aaron Feist Guardian Program, $5.5 million for youth mental health awareness and assistance training, $42 million, which is an increase of $22 million for school hardening grants, and $10 million for the Office of Safe Schools to implement safety initiatives. The Framework for Freedom budget continues our focus on civic engagement by providing $1 million to continue the Florida Civics and Debate Initiative, and $3.5 million to provide support to school districts for the improvement of civic literacy for students using regional civics literacy captains and coaches. Additionally, $10 million is provided to certify teachers to teach computer science and provide bonuses to teachers who hold educator certificates or industry certificates in computer science. The Framework for Freedom budget also proposes the establishment of the Heroes in the Classroom bonus initiative, providing $10 million to implement a recruitment bonus for retired military veterans and first responders who commit to joining the teaching profession. The Framework for Freedom budget provides $3.5 million to allow certified public school teachers to pursue their master's degree and become qualified to offer college-level dual enrollment general education courses on their high school campuses. And $9 million towards the creation of the Teacher Registered Apprenticeship Program and provides bonuses to our veteran teachers that mentor these new apprentice teachers. Florida continues to be number one in the nation for higher education for the fifth consecutive year in a row and was named lowest tuition in the nation for in-state students. The Framework for Freedom budget continues to build on this success with historic funding for the higher education systems by providing $1.6 billion for Florida's colleges and $3.1 billion for Florida State universities, while holding tuition constant with no increases. When Governor DeSantis came into office, he set a goal of becoming number one in the nation in workforce education. And to keep that commitment, more than $5 billion has been invested in workforce education since 2019. This year, the Framework for Freedom budget provides $20 million, which is an increase of $5 million, for the Pathway to Career Opportunities grant. And additionally, the budget provides the following performance-based funding in higher education: $30 million for the Student Success Incentives Funds in the Florida college system, $6.5 million and $20 million in funding for district and college workforce programs to be allocated based on students earning industry certifications in high-demand fields, $560 million in performance funding for the state university system. Performance will be based on metrics including percentage of graduates employed or continuing education, average wages of employed graduates, and graduation rates, and $100 million in a new university performance award for the recruitment and retention of highly qualified faculty at state universities. The Framework for Freedom budget provides more than $828 million in capital funding for school districts, charter schools, and colleges, including $220 million for the necessary infrastructure for public charter schools without utilizing any funds from school districts, and then $287.1 million in maintenance funding for state colleges, universities, lab schools, and the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind, as you can see listed out here on this slide. $174 million for remodeling and renovation construction costs at state universities and colleges, and $105 million for special facility construction projects in Glades, Gadsden, and Putnam counties. With the support of the legislature over the last 4 years, we have invested more than $3.3 billion in Everglades restoration and in the protection of our water resources, far surpassing Governor DeSantis' initial four-year goal of $2.5 billion. To continue this historic momentum and to conserve Florida for future generations, Governor DeSantis signed Executive Order 23-06, setting a new pledge of $3.5 billion over the next 4 years. This would require at least $875 million appropriated per year. The Framework for Freedom budget exceeds this goal by making the following commitments totaling $1.1 billion. $615 million for Everglades restoration, which includes the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or SERP, the C-43 Reservoir, Restoration Strategies, the EAA Reservoir, and the Lake Okeechobee Watershed Restoration Project. $370 million for targeted water quality improvements, including a grant program to convert septic systems and upgrades to rural and urban stormwater systems, from which $100 million is specifically provided for the Indian River Lagoon. $50 million to continue the grant program to help communities plan for and implement conservation, reuse, and alternative water supply projects. $50 million for springs restoration. $10 million for innovative technologies to combat harmful algal blooms. $11 million for continued water quality monitoring and blue-green algae task force. And $40 million to combat harmful algal blooms and red tide generally. The governor is also recommending over $406 million in Florida's resiliency. This brings the total amount of funding for the Resilient Florida Plan to $1.6 billion, fully funding the current resiliency plan projects and enabling more projects to be added. In order to protect and invest in our most critical environmental resources, the Framework for Freedom budget further provides $100 million for Florida Forever for land acquisition, with a focus on protecting our water resources. $45 million for maintenance and resource management for our state parks, $156 million to our beaches to address Florida's critically eroded shorelines, which includes $106 million in addition to what was provided in the last special session to fully fund the initial DEP damage assessments for beaches from Hurricanes Ian and Nicole, $195 million dedicated to focus on cleanup of contaminated sites to promote the redevelopment of these areas once cleanup has been completed, and $29 million for citrus protection, research, and awareness marketing efforts. The Framework for Freedom budget also includes $138.7 million in support for women and children. And this includes over $76 million for a rate increase for hospitals that provide acute inpatient services for neonatal and pediatric patients, and 5.4 million for a 5% increase in behavioral health rates for pediatric services in order to reduce the wait list for those services. The governor recommends $96.4 million in funding for child welfare initiatives, and the Framework for Freedom budget invests $384 million for mental health and substance abuse services, which includes $80 million to increase forensic bed capacity. $156.3 million is provided for the Substance Abuse Mental Health Block Grant to provide community-based services. $110.6 million is provided for the State Opioid Response Grant. $10 million is further provided for the following: community-based services for individuals with severe and persistent mental illness, competence restoration services for individuals in jail who have been deemed incompetent to proceed to trial, increasing the capacity to provide court-ordered competency restoration services for juveniles, and enhancing the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline services. And $27.2 million is provided to support mental health treatment facilities. The governor also includes $147.4 million, which is the state's share of the opioid settlement agreement, to establish the Office of Opioid Recovery at the Department of Children and Families. The Framework for Freedom budget provides $20 million for a new Florida Cancer Innovation Fund to award research grants to support groundbreaking cancer research. The governor also continues to put seniors first by investing over $130 million to provide support for Alzheimer's disease research, treatment, and services, increase services through the Home and Community Care for the Elderly programs, Hope Navigators to assist seniors overcome barriers to independent living, and grants that provide services including the provision of meals, transportation, and caregiver support. The Framework for Freedom budget also provides $79.6 million to remove an additional 1,200 individuals in crisis from the waitlist to be served through the Agency for Persons with Disabilities waiver program. The Framework for Freedom budget continues to make necessary investments in our public safety, including enhancing law enforcement and correctional officer safety and combating the flow of fentanyl into Florida from the southern border. As I mentioned in the pay package slide, $111.5 million is provided for the recruitment and retention of our correctional officers, and the governor also recommends $2.5 million to make Florida's correctional facilities safer, and $34.9 million and $37.4 million to improve juvenile and correctional infrastructure, respectively. Over $18 million to expand and enhance FDLE's crime databases, including the Biometric Identification Solutions Database, the Missing and Endangered Persons Information Clearinghouse, and the statewide sexual assault tracking system. $22 million is provided for state court due process resources, including $19.2 million for critical staff support. $12 million is provided for the creation of the Florida Scholars Academy, which will be a unified juvenile justice education system. And $22 million is provided in support to local law enforcement to create the State Assistance for Fentanyl Eradication, or SAFE, program, and the expansion of the Anti-Heroin Task Force statewide. The Framework for Freedom budget provides a significant investment in the State Guard, and the governor's recommended budget legislation also proposes to permanently codify the State Guard, which was reestablished in the current year budget implementing bill. The governor recommends more than $98 million for the Florida State Guard to support the training, compensation, and equipment for up to 1,500 State Guard members. These funds will provide for 10 positions to staff the State Guard leadership, $19 million for volunteer onboarding, training, and equipment, $3 million for maritime equipment and operations, $50 million for aviation equipment and operations, and $22 million for storage facilities for the assets acquired by the State Guard. The Framework for Freedom budget also places a significant focus on growing our National Guard and providing them with the necessary resources to enhance readiness for our emergencies. The governor recommends embarking on a five-year, $476 million capital initiative campaign at Camp Blanding, and the Framework for Freedom budget provides $178 million to fund years one and two of that initiative to build new training and housing facilities at Camp Blanding. The funding will also construct live fire ranges, infantry battle courses, and barracks to support simultaneous training of up to 5,000 guardsmen. When complete, these enhancements will elevate Florida's force readiness and reduce our dependence on federal and other states' resources during emergencies. The Framework for Freedom budget further proposes $7 million for the Revitalization and Modernization Program, or REVAMP, which we are launching. These funds will provide for year one of a renovation and remodeling initiative for all 63 readiness centers to meet safety standards and building code compliance. The Framework for Freedom budget also proposes $6.2 million to support the traditional maintenance and repairs at readiness centers throughout the state. Governor DeSantis is also proposing the Joint Enlistment Enhancement Program, or JEEP, to recruit and retain guardsmen in the Florida National Guard. This program provides $2 million for a one-time $1,000 bonus to guardsmen who renew their contract, and $1 million for $1,000 bonuses to guardsmen who recruit new members into the Florida National Guard. The Framework for Freedom budget also increases funding for the Florida National Guard Tuition Assistance Program by $3 million for a total of $6.2 million, and expands the program to allow for benefits to be transferred to a spouse or child if it remains unused by the National Guard soldier. In transportation and economic development, the Framework for Freedom budget provides $502.7 million in affordable and workforce housing initiatives, including $402.7 million to fully fund the Sadowski Affordable Housing Trust Funds, with $121.7 million for the State Apartment Incentive Loan Program, or SALE, and $281 million for the State Housing Initiatives Partnership Program, or SHIP. And additionally, $100 million is provided for the second year of the Hometown Heroes program that provides closing costs and down payment assistance to eligible homebuyers. The governor also recommends $2.1 billion in federal and state funding for recovery from prior disasters, as well as mitigation against future disasters. $100 million is provided for the Florida Job Growth Grant Fund, supporting economic growth by providing local areas with funding for public infrastructure and workforce training programs. $100 million is provided to continue the state marketing and promotion efforts of Visit Florida. $170.9 million is for the second phase of the State Small Business Credit Initiative, providing small businesses with access to additional capital. $30 million is provided for the second year of bonus payments for law enforcement officers who are new to the profession in the state, including those relocating from other states. $100 million is provided for the Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment, or BEAD, program to expand high-quality internet access deployment in rural communities. And $362.6 million in Community Development Block Grants, or CDBG, funds for local hurricane recovery and hardening efforts throughout the state. $22.5 million is provided for election oversight activities within the Department of State with a focus on election integrity and security. And $12 million is provided for the Unauthorized Alien Transport Program to facilitate transport of unauthorized aliens. The Framework for Freedom budget invests an historic $13.4 billion for the State Transportation Work Program, the state's ongoing five-year capital project plan for the implementation and completion of transportation infrastructure projects. In addition, Governor DeSantis recently announced his Moving Florida Forward plan for traffic congestion relief. With $4 billion of general revenue investment in the current fiscal year, this proposal would strengthen Florida's transportation infrastructure to accommodate for future growth of the state. Combining the $4 billion general revenue transfer with a series of recommended redirects of existing revenues, the Moving Florida Forward plan will commit $7 billion over 4 years to accelerate the development and completion of 20 priority transportation infrastructure projects. These revenues were historically dedicated to transportation infrastructure, but were redirected to support the General Revenue Fund during the Great Recession, and with the revenue picture of the state significantly improved and continuing to improve going forward, the governor believes it is time to reallocate these funds to support the infrastructure needs of our growing state. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Framework for Freedom budget on behalf of Governor Ron DeSantis, and I look forward to working with you as you craft the fiscal year 2023-2024 budget. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Members, do we have any questions? Seeing no questions. Just kidding. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Spencer. Comprehensive presentation, lots to digest, some really good things in there that Democrats have been fighting for a long time, so we're pleased with that. I'm going to, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, find my questions as I go through the presentations. The pay package that has been increased significantly for many of our state employees does not have the additional bump that some categories have as for public defenders. Mm-hmm. Was that intentional or was that an oversight?
Mr. Spencer, you're
right. Mr. Chair. So the public defenders benefit from the across-the-board pay increase that all state employees benefit from, but as part of the overall law enforcement side of the governor's pay package, there was a focus on the state attorneys, but the public defenders do experience an increase in appropriation as part of the overall pay package for all state employees as well.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, intentional then, not to give public defenders the additional bump.
You're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I wouldn't say it's intentional to exclude them. It was intentional to include all aspects of the law enforcement system, which includes the state attorneys.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Second. You're recognized.
Question, actually, as part of your presentation on education, and I've heard this before, that Florida is number one in education freedom. Can you explain who says that and why? What are the metrics in terms of identifying that?
Mr. Spencer, you recognized?
Mr. Chairman, so that statistic comes from the Heritage Foundation, and that comes based on the ability for students and professors to be able to have freedom in viewpoint, freedom. I mean, that's basically what they get down to, and that statistic is from the Heritage Foundation.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that published?
Mr. Chairman, yes, our staff is happy to share that with you.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You're
Thank you. On your framework for education, there's additional $10 million or $10 million total for the Heroes in the Classroom Bonus Initiative. Is there a status update on the performance of that program to date?
Mr. Spencer, you're recognized.
That program is being proposed to be established, and so once we, you know, we'll be able to share more information should this appropriation be secured. Thank you.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that not the veterans program that we do have currently?
Mr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, yes. So that program is being developed currently and being launched, and so I'm happy to go and talk with our Department of Education to see what more additional information about how, you know, the metrics that we're going to use to measure success will look. But once we get this $10 million secured by the legislature, we'll be able to implement this program and go and secure some pretty quality metrics on actual recruitment and retention of those individuals and licensing.
Representative Skidmore, you might be thinking about the Hometown Heroes program, which...
No?
No.
No, it was in the classroom. Veterans in the classroom.
You have another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I lost it. Oh, the Office of Opioid Recovery. Very excited about that. The opioid settlement agreement, that $147.4 million, is that recurring or was that a one-time revenue generation?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman. So it comes in, it's over the course of several decades. It's almost like the tobacco settlement dollars. So we're going to get a lot of money. It changes year over year. It's kind of like an annuity to the state, but we should be receiving funds consistent with that amount. We actually just received notice earlier this week that we're going to get more than that amount. So at the time of the development of this budget, we didn't know that we were getting the additional funds. So you'll see some availability for additional funds, but we should be expecting funds around that amount every year going forward.
Representative Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And the Office of Opioid Recovery, is its duties delineated somewhere? Is that established in some other part of the budget or in some of the conforming language?
Mr. Chairman, we're happy to go and get you some more details on how many FTE and some of the requirements that are part of the settlement agreement around that, but we have to establish this office as part of some of the general parameters that are contained in the settlement agreement. Other requirements in that settlement agreement require distribution to local governments, for example, and then different types of ways to use the money. But I know DCF has been working pretty tirelessly on developing what the implementation plan this looks like, and we're happy to send them over to talk to you and walk you through all those details.
Thank you.
Representative Skidmore, yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Mr. Spencer, what's the main difference between the missions of the State Guard and the National Guard, and is there overlap? Because it sounds like there is to me, and I'm wondering if there's some efficiencies that could be made there.
So, as this relates to the budget?
Mr. Chairman, so the National Guard as a dual command, you know, obviously can be federalized and used in the normal course of U.S. military operations. The State Guard is purely for the state. And where there is overlap is that both forces would be used in responding to the needs of the state during an emergency. There are some situations where it may make more sense to use the State Guard rather than using our National Guard. Because Florida's National Guard is 53 out of 54 of all states and territories in the amount of soldiers that we have per capita, our guardsmen get used a lot more than what the best practices would be for how many days of activation a National Guardsman would need to have. And so having the force of the State Guard to be able to go and assist with hurricane relief or to assist with any other matters that come up as a state of emergency would be able to reduce some of that burden on the National Guard and allow us to reprioritize and focus the National Guard when their need is the highest. And so that's where the overlap would be, but they are two separate, completely separate forces.
Representative Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there one that provides coordination for both so that there's, you know, they're not the Keystone Cops running around doing the same thing?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman. So, so the way that we're proposing to codify the State Guard, they would be administratively housed at the Department of Military Affairs. The director of the State Guard would report to the governor. So during a state of emergency, for example, under our unified command structure, the state coordinating officer is always established during a state of emergency, and that is the Division Emergency Management Director, Kevin Guthrie. Right over there. And so during a normal hurricane response, the state coordinating officer is in charge of you know, figuring out the deconflicting those overlaps that you're talking about. That same type of structure would be in place when the State Guard is fully operationalized. And so the state coordinating officer would be able to make sure that whatever missions are being fulfilled, the State Guard can go and do this aspect of it, the National Guard can go do that aspect of it, but you're deconflicting all of that through our current existing unified command structure.
Final question, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. Of the $115 billion in the governor's proposed budget, how much of the budget is from those hopeless federal spenders that are our partners in building this budget?
Mr. Chairman, we'd have to give you the exact number. Usually, depending on the year, it's anywhere from a third of the budget. Maybe a little bit more than a third of the budget, but I can get you the exact number and follow up. Most of that comes down through Medicaid dollars, traditional grant dollars over at education. There's other different federal programs, one-time federal programs this year, that particularly over at DEO's budget. There's a lot of that as well. So we'd be happy to get you the exact number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams, for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you spoke about the affordable housing program, what does this budget do to address the crisis that we have in here in Florida?
Mr. Chairman, so the governor for now the fifth budget in a row has recommended to fully fund the state's affordable housing programs, both SAIL and SHIP. In addition to that, with the Hometown Heroes program, we've seen a lot of success from that. This will be year two, if this gets appropriated, to be able to assist individual homeowner assistance. So SHIP and SAIL traditionally, while some of them, there is some aspects of the programs that go after single family home affordability, it's mostly for multifamily structures. And construction of multifamily structures or increasing the affordability of multifamily apartment-style structures. So the Hometown Heroes program, if it gets codified and if it gets funded for a second year, will continue that focus of putting additional resources towards promoting affordability also of that aspect of home ownership. With the $500+ million that we're recommending in general affordable housing and workforce affordability initiatives, we feel this is a pretty robust investment in workforce and homeowner affordability.
Follow-up.
Representative Williams, for follow-up.
Will this assist first-time buyers or rentals that's having problems in this crisis?
You're recognized.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes. So that is SHIP and SAIL also relate directly to anybody, whether they're a first-time renter or home buyer, but the whole purpose of the Hometown Heroes program is within the list of occupations that are eligible, that it's for down payment and closing cost assistance for first-time home buyers.
Representative Williams, for a follow-up.
Thank you. During this crisis, we see a lot of seniors that's on fixed incomes having major problems. Will this also assist them in this?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so there's a lot of different programs for senior home affordability, both through, usually it's over at Department of Elder Affairs. We'd be happy to get you a breakdown specifically of all the different aspects between what's our traditional home affordability programs over at Florida Housing Finance Corporation, combined with anything that's over at Elder Affairs, and we can get you a breakdown of what that is specifically for seniors.
Representative Williams, for a follow-up.
Thank you. We have a lot of programs you are absolutely right to assist our seniors. But during the time of the crisis, we have noticed that a lot of these programs do not have funds available. What does this budget say about the Sadowski Fund? Are we sweeping the Sadowski Fund this year?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, the governor recommends fully funding the Sadowski funds as we've done every year for the last 5 years.
Representative Williams.
Thank you. Do we have anything that I didn't hear you mention about corporate giveaways or tax cuts for the rich and famous?
Mr. Chairman,
Spencer,
I would not characterize anything in the governor's tax package as a corporate giveaway or a tax cut for the rich and famous.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I give someone else.
All right, Leader Driscoll, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Spencer. And thank you for this presentation. That's a lot of information. I did want to focus in, at least to start, on Medicaid and kid care reversion. So as I understood it, on slide 8 or so of your presentation, it shows a current year revenue adjustment due to Medicaid and kid care reversion that contributes to the general revenue surplus. So how much in general revenue savings are you anticipating from this Medicaid reversion?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so there's about $1.2 billion or so worth of GR reversions as part of Medicaid, and that's as a result of adopting the Social Services Estimating Conference numbers, which include a bit of a reduction overall in caseload, and then also just some general estimating conference adjustments that are made in Medicaid, and that impacts kid care as well. And this is also due in part to the continuation of the enhanced FMAP. Mm-hmm.
Leader Driscoll.
Right, and I do want to talk about that federal Medicaid assistance percentage, that FMAP. But so to be clear, even though our Medicaid enrollment numbers are the highest that they've ever been, really due to the public health emergency that was COVID, Florida's actually saving money and funding due to the increased federal funding match rate, about 6.2%. Is that FMAP currently, as I understand it? Is that correct? We're actually saving money?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so we were having a lower cost share for these individuals that were enrolled on Medicaid. That is true. However, with the Consolidated Appropriations Act passed by Congress at the end of last year, that enhanced FMAP rate is going to start going down. And so by the end of this year, that's going to be phased out. Projecting forward, if our caseload is currently maintained, the overall GR spend by the state will radically increase. And so now, of course, redeterminations are going to take place once that is authorized, which begins in April. So there will be a bit of catch-up to play as that FMAP enhanced rate declines as well.
Leader Driscoll.
So the increased federal funding rate for Medicaid over the past 3 years has enabled us to cover more Floridians while costing less.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's enabled us to cost less because we still had to appropriate more money in order to cover the higher caseload. There's also been, because of our ASR statutes, there's been a significant amount of money that has been deferred to the managed care system because the way that our structure is set up, that we lose the first couple dollars of the first 10% of savings through our managed care system. We lose the first couple dollars. We split with the managed care companies the middle, and then the rest goes back to us. If you have over 1 million people on Medicaid more, 1.5 million people on Medicaid more than pre-pandemic, assuming, which I think is a safe assumption, that a good portion of those individuals may no longer be eligible for Medicaid under traditional measures by income and may not be using any services, you're still losing dollars to the managing to the system because of the ASR statute, even if they're not using any service whatsoever while they're enrolled on Medicaid, until they get disenrolled. And so the state has to appropriate more GR in order to cover our state match for more people, even though not all those people may actually be using any services whatsoever.
Leader Driscoll.
Thank you. But I think that's precisely my point, because in the end, even if we just look at this, the past 3 years kind of as a case study, there's more that we get to revert back to general revenue in terms of savings. And so it would seem to me, since we've been able to cover more Floridians under Medicaid during this public health emergency while reverting over $1 billion. And I calculated it at around $1.7 billion, but I know you said $1.2, so we could probably have a conversation offline about those numbers and whether or not we can get them to match up. If we've been able to do this while reverting at least over $1 billion in state funding from the Medicaid program each year due to that 6.2% FMAP increase, doesn't that essentially provide proof of concept for the fact that roughly 30%, a 30% FMAP increase that's available if we expand Medicaid is an opportunity for us to provide health coverage to uninsured Floridians while also freeing up state funding for other priorities that the governor may have?
Mr. Chairman, so the reversion that's taking place because of that continuation of the FMAP is a reversion of a much higher baseline of appropriation level. The state is still having to appropriate a lot more money because of the fact that we have 5.5 million people enrolled on Medicaid versus 3.9 million people on Medicaid. The overall amount of money the state is spending is still higher now on Medicaid than it was pre-pandemic. So while we may be reverting money based on the prior year appropriation, we're still spending more money than we were pre-pandemic on Medicaid.
Leader Driscoll.
Thank you. Does the net of the savings outweigh the additional increase in federal funding that you're referencing?
Mr. Chairman, no. The net, the amount of reversions that the state has received from having the enhanced FMAP does not outweigh the amount of increased appropriation that is required to support the higher level of Medicaid enrollment.
Thank you. Leader Driscoll.
What was the amount of the additional state spending?
Mr. Spencer.
I'll have to get you the breakdown over the last 4 years, going back to pre-pandemic and the last three fiscal years. But we've been tracking this, and there's, you know, especially as we lose the FMAP enhanced rate now, if we maintain that current caseload, it's a significant cost driver for the state.
Leader Driscoll.
Moving on to an additional, thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on to an additional topic, it looks like there's close to a $64 million decrease in early learning services. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, any of the changes that you would see year over year decrease in early learning comes as a result of non-recurring issues not being restored. Every year there's a whole host of non-recurring issues that are brought in there, and also the drop off of various different federal grants that come in there. When it comes to actual base operations for early learning, it's been consistent, and actually we had some increases in certain program areas.
Another question, thank you, Mr. Chair, in the healthcare realm, it looks like there's about a 9% decrease in funding for ACA. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, so this year, the governor took a policy position to treat the low-income pool the same way that we've been treating the directed payment program for the last two fiscal years. If you're familiar with the directed payment program, that's one of the several supplemental payment programs that we have in the ACA budget. The DPP program is not appropriated authority in the budget, but rather given authority through the implementing bill to come to the LBC once the actual model is ready. The amount of IGTs that are generated to support the program have been documented, and the letters of agreement are in place from all of the IGT-generating bodies. So then a budget amendment is submitted from ACA through the governor's office to the LBC to secure that drawdown of over $2 billion for DPP. Traditionally, prior to the existence of DPP, LIP was appropriated an amount of authority, generally less than what the maximum federal authority is provided from CMS. This year, we decided to treat LIP the same as DPP. And rather than appropriating an arbitrary amount of budget authority in the GAA, we felt it was appropriate to allow for a budget amendment to be brought to the LBC the same way that DPP is handled, up to the maximum amount that CMS provides to the state based on actual IGT generation, so that the LIP model can actually be based on what the drawdown will be.
Thank you.
Leader Driscoll.
Mr. Spencer, are you able to answer any questions about the governor's proposed implementing and conforming bills?
Mr. Spencer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and yes, Leader, I can.
Okay, yep. Great. Could I ask?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to talk about the proposed implementing and conforming bill that basically expands the definition of the Capitol complex for purposes of determining the Department of Management Services duties in providing safety and security services. Could you talk a little bit about that? I don't think that's something that we've seen before, and just explain perhaps the bill as you understand it and why the governor believes this is a priority.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so we have a large number of different memorials and monuments that are in the hopper right now to be developed. We have the Dozier Memorial, we have Holocaust Memorial, Slavery Memorial, all of these that are in the budget over prior years being developed. We're looking at trying to expand the amount of territory here in the Capitol downtown that we can place some of these projects. Frankly, we're running out of space here on the block that we've got at the Capitol.
Thank you. I'll let someone else ask some questions for now.
Representative Benjamin for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Spencer, for being here today. And I presented us this budget. I have a few questions with some of the presentation that I've heard here today. One of those is that I noticed that there are some permanent tax cuts with regards to things like baby and toddler necessities, cribs and strollers. But then I see gas stoves has a permanent tax break, while dental and oral hygiene products has just a one-year tax break. And understanding how our dental health corresponds with our overall health, would the governor be okay with changing that and making it a permanent tax break on par with maybe gas stoves?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Spencer.
We're always open to have a conversation about more tax cuts, so that's something that we'd be happy to have a conversation with the legislature about. I will say that there is a deliberate decision between what things were made permanent versus what were not made permanent when we had the consideration of the impacts of inflation. And so a lot of these things that are not permanent, household necessities that are under $25 in value, a lot of these things that people buy frequently, you know, when you have higher inflation, costs are higher, the taxes that the state generates off of that is higher. We benefit from sales tax collections on that. We don't need to have all the money that we have right now. Our reserves are at historic levels. If we can try to deliver some relief to consumers against inflation by reducing the costs on those products that people buy regularly and consistently throughout the year until inflation eventually gets under control, that was the priority that we were trying to drive with some of these temporary tax cuts. On some of the more lumpy investments that a household may make, you don't buy a gas stove more than once every, you know, sometimes only once in the entire time you live in the house. So those are things that we felt was appropriate to be a permanent tax cut.
Representative Benjamin for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go to our budgeting around our justice system as a whole. Seems that we are good with spending a lot of money with regards to the law enforcement segment of our justice system. But what I'm seeing is when it comes to our judiciary branch and when it comes to areas like our public defender's office, we're a little lax in terms of how much we're willing to appropriate in those areas. For instance, the public defender's office has 250 plus vacant positions out of 1,600. And a 27% turnover. Keep in mind that the function that the public defender's office does is to safeguard your right to counsel when you are charged with a crime. And so I would like to know, would the governor consider putting public defenders on the same pay considerations as we do their colleagues on the other side, the state attorneys, because they perform an important task as well as the state attorneys? Would you agree?
Let me just jump in here. Recall that the governor is making a proposal and the legislature makes the appropriations.
And that's
so we'll have those opportunities to have those discussions. But and I think Mr. Spencer has already answered the question about why state attorneys were included in the special bump and public defenders were not. But do you have another question?
No. And you're right, Mr. Chair, that we ultimately do have it, but we know that there is this thing called line item vetoes and line item adjustments. So what I want to ensure is that the governor's okay if we do decide to appropriate or put them on even playing ground, that's something that the governor finds acceptable.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, I can't commit to any decision the governor will make related to his line item veto authority, but what I can commit to is I will discuss that matter with our team and with the governor.
Thank you very much.
Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
Thank you. When we get to education, and again, I know it is our purview with regards to how we appropriate money, I'm I am interested to hear what the governor believes about something our scholarship programs, such as our big one that the Florida Lottery is supposed to fund. We've seen an increase in the requirements for that scholarship because it is said that we don't put enough money into it for the amount of people that that is requiring it. And that's the Bright Future Scholarship Program. How does the governor feel about appropriating additional funds to increase the amount of money that we spend on Bright Futures so that we can have more students actually avail themselves of that opportunity?
Mr. Spencer, Chairman, as it relates to the budget in front of you.
So the Bright Futures Scholarship Program all goes through the estimating conference process based on an estimate of what the actual enrollment of students will be and who we believe will be eligible for the program. There's no amount of additional funding that's needed in order to fully fund the program as it's currently statutorily structured. Any changes to the Bright Futures program that would necessitate an increase in funding would require a policy change. And so we'd be happy to discuss any policy changes you'd like to see on the Bright Futures program. But as of in this budget, we fully fund the caseload, the estimate of what would be needed for the Bright Futures scholarship program.
Representative Benjamin, as to the budget proposal in front of you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As it relates to the funding that goes to Florida A&M University, I see that there's a decrease in that funding under the governor's proposal. Can you tell us why?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so all of the decreases that were at FAMU or any of the HBCUs that are in the budget, there's several that you'll see some decreases, all relate to non-recurring projects that were line item projects that were put in the budget that we traditionally do not restore non-recurring one-year projects. We maintained the amount of operational funding for all of those institutions.
Thank you. Thank
you. Representative Honchowski for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I had just a few questions. On page 18, I was, first of all, very thrilled with the mental health allocation increase as well as the safe schools allocation increase. My question is regarding the teacher salary allocation increase. How is that handled? And I guess I'll start with how is that handled in its distribution?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so this $200 million segment is different than the portion that was appropriated in the current year GAA, which, as you know, in the GAA currently, that portion was split 50-50 between raising base and then also going to veteran teachers, not military veteran, anyone else who's not at base. So this money is given without any of those restrictions. It can go to any instructional personnel as the school district sees necessary. Because we've succeeded in our goal of raising the base pay above the $47,500 that the governor had committed to when we established this categorical. But now we'd like to continue to see pay go up, and we acknowledge that there is some need to allocate resources for raising not just base pay, but all instructional personnel as well.
Representative Honchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I just ask, would any of this be able to go toward, because we hear this a lot in our communities, the support staff, the school counselors, it is School Counselors Week in Florida, or school psychologists?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so it wouldn't go to anyone who's not considered an instructional personnel. So to the extent that any support staff, as you define it, would be instructional personnel, they could benefit from it, depending on the decision of the district to support it. But if they're not instructional personnel, they would not be benefiting from this program. I know school mental health counselors and psychologists do benefit from the mental health allocation.
Representative Honchowski.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. On page 20, I was very happy to see the K through 12 workforce. Is this an increase or is this status quo, the performance funding?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so it's a $5 million increase for the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant. I believe it's for the $30 million for the Student Success Incentive Funds. The remainder of those mostly are maintaining current levels of funding, because we've seen some pretty strong success from these initiatives at the current level of funding.
Representative Honchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate my glasses today. A couple of questions. Regarding the forensic bed capacity and study, my community, and I believe every community in the state, is having issues with enough forensic bed capacity. Would this amount be an increase? And if so, how many beds would be foreseen in this increase? And is it area specific?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman. So yes, it would definitely be an increase. I know that we've handled this issue differently a couple of different ways in the last two fiscal years. We've gone to the LBC a couple of times to try to get additional authority to pay for additional forensic bed capacity. What we're doing in this budget is we're doing both front and back of bill. We're doing $38 million in the back of the bill through federal funds to do an immediate increase in forensic bed capacity, and then also trying to address that more long-term. Part of that's going to be a study to try to figure out what's the best long-term solution to address this problem. Do we need to construct a new facility? Do we need to go to more outsourced contracted solution? There's pretty robust proviso that we set in the governor's budget recommendation that directs the different options to look at and study that. So hopefully the legislature is armed next fiscal year with some information on what is that permanent solution. But for right now, the priority is to get more capacity online. I can get you the exact number between both the current year, the back of bill that we're recommending, and the 23-24 number. Don't have it in front of me, but I can get that in front of you.
Representative Honchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the opioid settlement agreement. I know that there will be a trust fund, I believe, put together, or it's in the process of. Could you explain just a little bit of that process to me, and then I'll see if my question actually makes sense in the framework of that process.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so we're still at this time reviewing the settlement agreement and evaluating all the different programs that we currently do to address substance abuse and opioid issues. DCF has a pretty long list of different programs they support, whether it's through managing entities, CBCs, those types of entities. We are evaluating what that would look like. Our recommendation was to go and authorize that authority from the mental health or from the settlement funds, establish the office, and then be able to then move forward from there and support these initiatives that we have the best metrics for success. Similar to how we currently handle things like our SOAR grant, our substance abuse and mental health grants that we manage at DCF.
Representative Honchowski, you recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I bring this up is we have a lot of substance use disorder in our jails, and people are ending up in jail not necessarily because, it's because the underlying issue is either a mental health issue or a substance use disorder issue. And so I wonder if there is some plan in this to also address some of that medication-assisted treatment in the jail, so that when people are coming out, that they have a chance of not coming back in.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, I know that we do a lot around medication-assisted treatment across the various different grants that we have. I'd have to go back and talk to the team and see what aspects of that would have any in-jail aspects to it, and then we're happy to come back and discuss that matter with you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Skidmore for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've noticed in this budget that there is a lot of different pots that add up to a huge amount of reserves. There's also all the tax breaks. You get a car, you get a car, you get a car. But I've also noticed that there are some trust fund sweeps. Mm-hmm. Particularly out of the Department of Financial Services and the Department of Health. Is there a further opportunity to collect less of those taxes if we're not going to use the money, or are we not using the money that we should be using for different programs? Why is there so much that we're able to sweep out of those trust funds?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Spencer.
So we're only recommending $38 million in sweeps, which is pretty low, historically speaking, and only out of three trust funds. The trust funds that we're specifically sweeping are ones that accumulate revenues just based on operations and based on other types of activity, not necessarily indicative of are we charging too much for something. It's just is more stuff happening. Trust funds generally accumulate large balances depending on what they're for. In our budget, we recommend over $2.5 billion worth of retained unused trust fund balances. We like to make sure that we have those balances available in trust funds. It provides nimbleness to the state in the event of a decline in revenues. You want to make sure that those revenues are in those trust funds for their intended purpose. But there's also opportunities when you have some trust funds that have significant retained balances that don't necessarily need to maintain those, then we can go ahead and recommend a sweep. So this $38 million was just our based on that evaluation, what we thought was appropriate to do some sweeps just to maintain some consistency to our strategy there.
Representative Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long are those funds being accumulated? Is it a significant amount of time to get to this level? Mm-hmm. Or is there really an opportunity to tax less? I know that that is obviously a mission of the governor. So is there an additional opportunity for individuals to pay less into the state? If these are trust fund dollars, people are putting their trust that it's going to be used for the purpose that they put the money into it. And if that's not happening, isn't there an opportunity for us to not collect it?
Mr. Spencer,
you want Mr. to Chairman, track of that? So the trust funds exist as long as the legislature continues to authorize them. They're on a regular rotation, I think it's maybe 5 years, unless the legislature deems shorter for reauthorization. To your point of the people trust to pay into the trust funds for the funds to be there, they also trust that the services that those trust funds will support will be provided in the event of a decline in revenues. And so that is why we structure so many trust funds that we have in state government to support those ongoing agency operations, whether it's licensing functions at DBPR or whether it's law enforcement pay for FHP troopers. These trust funds exist so that if general revenue takes a 10% hit in a year, that we don't have to go and lay off, 10% of the state workforce. There's funds available there to continue those operations of state government. And that's why we count them towards our reserves, because that's what they're there for. If we do see a decline in revenues, we can continue a level of government services and operations that will provide those services that the public expects to come from the state. And in addition to that, the $2 billion that we're recommending to cut this year is the largest tax reduction that any governor has ever recommended, any legislature has ever appropriated. So we do feel that we are adequately addressing the issue of taxation.
All right. Representative Benjamin for another bite at the apple.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to have some questions with regards to Florida's National Guard. I remember when we first started talking about improving our National Guard, we were talking about an addition of like 200 people. What is it grown through this budget? What are we looking now? How many people are we looking to appropriate for now?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so you might be thinking about the State Guard as far as the number of people we wanted. So right. We're currently at 400 volunteers that our current appropriation the State Guard can support. We want to get up to 1,500. In the National Guard, unfortunately, we don't control the amount of National Guard soldiers that are authorized for the state. That's a federal formula, and in large part depends on things like we're proposing here for this level 2 training facility expansion. When the Pentagon and the National Guard Bureau are deciding where to allocate and expand these forces, they factor in what can the state actually support. Can we actually train 5,000 guardsmen at Camp Blanding simultaneously? Can we actually support all the different types of training that has to happen for our units without having to send them to North Carolina or up the East Coast or over to the West Coast? Our goal is to try to be able to accommodate all of those different fixed capital outlay enhancements that we will need to do at Camp Blanding to put ourselves in the best position to receive an increase in our force limit in the state of Florida. Because again, Florida is 53 out of 54 of all states and territories when it comes to the number of guardsmen that we have authorized here per capita. And we're a hurricane-prone state. We have significant levels of activation throughout the year. Our guardsmen are overworked. They have some of the highest days per year of activation. And so we need to try to do everything that we can to try to support these projects to be able to put ourselves in the best position to justify additional soldiers being assigned to Florida.
Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, because I didn't mean to talk about our state guard. Okay. I posit that question again in regards to our State Guard. How many forces are we looking to appropriate for our State Guard?
Mr. Spencer, as proposed on the budget.
Mr. Chairman, so that'll go up to 1,500 from the current 400. as authorized.
Representative Benjamin.
And the type of training that, these guardsmen are looking to get, what type of training is that, considering that the function, their primary function is to help in emergency situations?
So you may have very cleverly wrapped in an actual question on the approach process there at the end. So are there funds wrapped in for training into this budget?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is. So of the $19 million, of the total $98 million, a part of that is for training.
Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I heard mention of infantry training. Can you tell me how that rolls into what their function is?
Is that a question on the proposal?
Yes, because part of the proposal was said.
Part of the training budget here include infantry training?
Mr. Chairman, the infantry training we're talking about was specific to the level two project over at Camp Blanding. That's the $178 million to try to go and do the infantry battalion battle courses and all of that stuff. That's for the National Guard.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, are you sure? You feel compelled to ask another question?
Yes, sir.
Representative Williams for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stepped away for a couple minutes, but I'm going back to the housing crisis that we have. I haven't heard anything mentioned about helping our homeowners with the property taxes that they're having. Right now, it's a major problem in the state of Florida. Is there anything mentioned or is anything in the budget that will assist our homeowners with property taxes and insurance?
Mr. Chairman, property taxes is a constitutional matter. We can't provide exemptions to property taxes without the citizens passing a referendum. The state of Florida does not set property taxes in the budget. The only thing that we do related to property taxes is set the millage rate in the education budget, which we've kept fixed from current year to this next year. Other than that, there's not much that can be done in this budget related to trying to cut property taxes. When it comes to insurance, the governor has been, and this, Mr. Chairman, if I'm jumping into much policy here, I apologize. The governor has been a champion for tort reform issues over the last two special sessions that we've addressed. We've supported the increase in appropriation to OIR for them to have more, better paid and more actuaries as they're evaluating the financial solvency of these insurance companies. And this budget includes the $1 billion reserve for the Florida Optional Reinsurance Assistance Program, as well as the existing $1.1 billion retained balance that's in the RAP program, the reinsurance to assist policyholders. So between those two programs, we have over $2 billion of state-supported backing in the reinsurance market, and the premiums collected on the FORA program leveraged up to be able to provide some pretty healthy amount of reinsurance support in those layers below the CAT fund. That is the best way that we can try to provide some relief in addition to the policy changes in tort reform matters and reforming the litigation environment to try to deliver some relief for our property insurance market.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, sir. So if I'm understanding correctly, there are $2 billion in this budget that will assist homeowners with insurance problems that they are having. Will it be a breakdown that we can actually see that, or will that be included in a lump sum with the $502 million that you spoke of earlier?
Mr. Spencer?
Mr. Chairman, there is no breakdown because the $1.1 billion of retained in the RAP program was already appropriated. That's sitting over at, actually it's sitting in GR right now, available to the SBA. The $1 billion that's available for FORA was also appropriated in the special session in December. That is sitting in GR as well, but again, also available for the SBA to be able to pay it out as reinsurance under the CAT fund layers. So that is the breakdown.
Representative Williams.
Thank you. So we already have the money available. It's just not being used to assist our homeowners. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, it's not being used because there hasn't been claims against it yet.
At least tell us what song it is.
He's the revenue guy.
All right. Thank you, guys. Seeing no further questions, that'll conclude the committee's agenda today. But before we depart, please join me in congratulating Representative Andrade and his wife on the birth of their new baby daughter, Jillian. And with that, Vice Chair McClure moves, we rise.